Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
The reception we have been receiving to the people of South Africa throughout the nine provinces has humbled us to understand that our message resonates with the needs of the people of South Africa.
South Africa's Inkatha Freedom Party, or IFP, is considering the formation of a coalition government with other opposition parties.
Firstly, I would like to ensure that the opposition is united as a bloc in engaging the government in constructive criticism.
The leader of the opposition in parliament wants unity to help hold the Malawian government accountable to the people.
They're inviting us for the police leadership. They're inviting us for a meeting on Monday. We said we shall go for that meeting because we have been seeking to, you know, if they want to engage with us, that's okay. So we are going to meet them on Monday to tell them to explain to us about the double standards.
And the Ugandan police invite the opposition National Unity Platform for a meeting in Kampala on Monday. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In South Africa, the leader of the opposition Inkatha Freedom Party, or IFP, says the group will consider the formation of a coalition government with other opposition parties if the governing African National Congress, or ANC, fails to win a parliamentary majority in the coming national elections on Wednesday. Velenkosini Hlabisa says he is impressed with how South Africans have embraced the IFP's nationwide campaign in the run-up to the polls. He also expressed confidence that a coalition of parties will defeat the ANC, adding that South Africans appear to have lost confidence in the ruling party. His remarks come as political analysts say the IFP could be a governing coalition partner of the ANC if the ruling party fails to win over 50% at the polls. For more on the electoral prospects of the IFP, I reach Velenkosini Hlabisa.
The IFP campaign has been amazing and inspiring. The reception we have been receiving to the people of South Africa throughout the nine provinces has humbled us to understand that our message resonates with the needs of the people of South Africa. Wherever we have been campaigning, we have been receiving thousands of our people in South Africa coming to our rallies, gatherings, to listen to our message. The door-to-door campaigns that we have been doing, we have been receiving a warm welcome in all the families that we have visited, not even a single one, chased us away or shut their doors when they saw us coming. This is very encouraging because we know this time around, the people of South Africa want to be well informed so that on the 29th of May, they make an informed decision not to vote by heart, but to apply their brain to choose a political party with a manifesto that is addressing their challenges, especially our youth and women who are on the receiving end of countless challenges in South Africa.
Mr. Hlabisa, what do you say to political analysts in South Africa who are saying that the Inkatha Freedom Party, or the IFP, is possibly a potential coalition partner for the ANC if the party is unable to attain the at least 50% threshold in parliament?
Yeah, the analyst must not talk on behalf of the IFP. The IFP is campaigning to remove the ANC from power, and the analyst must not drag the IFP on questions of coalition with the ANC, because that will confuse the voters, not knowing if they vote the IFP, are they assisting the ANC. The IFP is campaigning this election in order to remove the government that has failed our people over a period of 30 years. And the people of South Africa, when they show a vote of no confidence to the ANC, it would not be a good thing to bring it back through back door when people have spoken loud and clear that they no longer need it to be in power.
Does that mean, Mr. Hlabisa, that the IFP will consider forming a coalition with other opposition parties to form a government, since you said the IFP wants the ANC out?
Definitely. The first option, if we don't get a majority vote, we will consider that can we not get a majority vote with other opposition parties? Because, you know, if people of South Africa have voted out the ANC and denied it the majority, they will be giving a vote of no confidence. I know, as a South African, people of South Africa want a change. They want a government that will create jobs and load shedding, deal with crime, deal with corruption, and all these elements I've just mentioned are associated with the ruling party because it has failed the dreams and aspirations of our youth. So now, if we don't get an overwhelming majority, we will be looking at parties that we can partner with to form a new government, to come with fresh ideas and give a new direction to our country that is at the brink of collapsing.
Well, the IFP is an alliance partner in the multi-party charter. What is the prospect of this charter ahead of the elections?
No, anything is possible. There are 14 million people who are registered but not participating in the election process. We are mobilizing the dormant voters, the 14 million people, to take an active role in going to the voting station and vote out the government that has failed them. The possibility is very great for the multi-party charter because people want change and they want parties who have demonstrated to be ethical, who can demonstrate to be a good government. The IFP is already in partnership with the Democratic Alliance at a local government level, where we are having functional governments that are able to change the lives of the people of South Africa.
Velenkosini Hlabisa is the leader of the opposition in Inkatha Freedom Party, or IFP. He spoke with me from Johannesburg, South Africa. In Malawi, the leader of the opposition in parliament says unity among opposition lawmakers is a major initiative to help hold the government accountable to the people. George Chaponda was responding to criticism that the opposition in parliament is weak and ineffective to play its constitutionally mandated role to ensure the administration's transparency and accountability. Chaponda, who is from the main opposition Democratic Progressive Party, or DPP, replaces Duane Nankumwa. Nankumwa formed his own party, People's Development Party, after he was expelled from the DPP over disagreement with leaders of the group. For more about his plans as leader of the opposition in the legislature, I reach parliamentarian George Chaponda.
Firstly, I would like to ensure that the opposition is united as a bloc in engaging the government in constructive criticism. I am aware, as you have rightly said, that in the past, the opposition was weak. But this time, because we'll be a united front, this will not happen. Number two, or secondly, we feel that there are so many things which have been happening in this country, and the government has been promising much, but when it comes to realities, nothing happens. For instance, the arrest of the SCB director and subsequent transfer to Namitete Police on December 6, 2022, Nothing has happened. The arrest of human rights activists Kalindo, Namiwa, Bile Banda, and others for mere exercising their constitutional right of demonstrating. Again, nothing has happened.
You talked about the issue of corruption. As a leader of the opposition, what role can you play in ensuring that the fight against corruption is won, at least from a member of parliament perspective?
What we have for ourselves to ensure is firstly ensure that there is the independence of the SCB, because the SCB is the one which is involved in the whole pursuing the issue of corruption in this country. And if it is not independent, or if it is threatened, or it is compromised, then that means there will be nothing happening.
Isn't the structure itself a problem, since the appointing authority, that is the president in this case, appoints the head of the Anti-Corruption Bureau? So how do you change it? Must the law of anti-corruption be changed in order to make it effective and independent?
The independence, if actually in implementation, if during implementation, what the law says was followed, then that means the independence will be there. For instance, the SCB director is to be appointed. Definitely, there's no problem with the appointment. But then we have also the parliament, the public appoints committee that has to approve. And this process is well and good. We have no problem with that one. But what we ourselves we worry is actually when that officer, the executive director, is fails to carry out his or her job because of fearing what can happen to her, as it was the case which we said there was an incident where the person, because was had mentioned certain things, was removed and taken to Namitete police station on December 6, 2022, and so on. That was a threat to the individuals. Since then, nothing has happened. The person has been silenced, and my feeling is that the person is now fearing her own life and therefore has to compromise. I don't think can be as independent as she initially wanted to be.
You come from the biggest opposition party in Malawi. The party, a lot of Malawians say, has shown signs of friction within top leadership that even led to an expulsion of the former leader of opposition in parliament, as well as the former information minister, Mark Butumani. What makes you confident that you'll be able to unite the party and hold the government accountable as leader of the opposition?
I am confident that we'll do that, because we have also a president, former president, who is the president of our party, Professor Arthur Peter Mutharika. He is a Democrat. As you know, he was teaching in the United States for over 40 years, a renowned professor of law. And he was also involved in the drafting of the Constitution of Malawi. He's a person who has demonstrated in the past, when he was in power, that the country really, he follows the issue to the maximum in terms of pursuing things in the most transparent and accountable manner.
George Aponda is the leader of the opposition in parliament. He spoke with me from the Malawian capital, Lilongwe. Kenya's President William Ruto has wrapped up his state visit to Washington, which focused heavily on trade, international finance, and economic development. In an exclusive VOA interview, Ruto says he is pleased with the progress he made on the trip in broadening trade with the United States. He spoke with my colleague Huba Abdi with VOA Swahili Service on a range of issues. Here is the conclusion of their conversation.
The U.S. has reaffirmed its support for Kenyan government in sending or deploying troops to Haiti. but US and major other countries have refrained from sending their troops to Haiti. Back home, there's an active case in court in regards to this deployment. The same court has termed this as unconstitutional and illegal. Mr. President, why are you still determined in sending troops to Haiti?
Three things. Number one, the deployment of our security officers to Haiti has been endorsed by cabinet. Both houses of parliament have ratified. We have met all international requirements. And in fact, we have complied with the very court order you are referring to. The court asked us to have an agreement signed between Kenya and Haiti, specifically to facilitate this deployment. The Prime Minister of Haiti traveled to Kenya, and we witnessed jointly the signing of that agreement that now paves way, and in compliance with the directions of the court. And beyond that, I have also asked the transition presidential council in Haiti, the new arrangement there, to ratify and to confirm that they recognize the agreement that was signed between Kenya and witnessed by the former Prime Minister and myself. And I have it in writing that they confirm that the current administration recognizes that agreement, and it is on that basis that we will be deploying our troops, and also in compliance with the UN regulations and UN requirements under the UN peacekeeping efforts.
But Mr. President, you are on record saying that you will ignore court order that seeks to stop the execution of this mission. And with the new active case in court, will you still go on in sending the troops?
I think you have your facts are not correct. I don't think there is any place that I have said myself or my administration will ignore any court order, because we are a country that believes in the rule of law.
With the new active,
we complied with the court order that was issued. When the court said this will be done by signing an agreement, we went out of our way. We asked the Prime Minister of Haiti to travel to Nairobi, which he did, and we signed the agreement. So we are in proper compliance.
Well, you have said you're determined to send troops in Haiti. Don't you think that there's so much issues within the EAC member state, neighboring countries, Sudan, South Sudan, Somalia and DRC? Why is it not you concentrate first on these countries that have been having insecurity issues for a very long time?
We have 5,000 troops in Somalia for the last 12 years. We have supported DRC. We are working with South Sudan. In fact, as I talk to you, there's a big team in Nairobi of South Sudan, different teams that are negotiating their issues in Nairobi to have elections and to secure their country. As late as last weekend, we had also teams from Sudan itself, again working towards their peace. So, and we have 15 other countries where Kenya has missions to support peace and security.
That was President William Ruto of Kenya, who just ended a landmark state visit to Washington. He was speaking with my colleague Huba Abdi.
This week on Straight Talk Africa, there has been war inside Sudan for a year. Fighting between the Sudanese armed forces and the paramilitary rapid support forces has reduced much of the capital to rubble and displaced millions of people. Can this conflict end peacefully through negotiations? Join me, Vincent McCorry, for an in-depth look at the civil war in Sudan on the next Straight Talk Africa, Wednesday at 18:30 UTC.
The Ugandan police have invited the opposition National Unity Platform, or NUP, for a meeting in the capital, Kampala, on Monday. It comes after the opposition party submitted a protest letter accusing the police of bias. The NUP accused the police of routinely using excessive force to stop or prevent its political activities across the country. The police deny the accusations and have invited the opposition leadership for the meeting. It comes as the NUP embarks on a nationwide campaign to drum up support for the party ahead of the next general election. For more information about the coming meeting and the expectations of the opposition NUP, I reach Joel Senyonyi. He is the spokesperson for the NUP.
So yesterday, we took a protest letter to the police headquarters, and we told the police we are disturbed by these double standards. Everybody else is out there doing political activities. Why is it that NUP is bad? So today, because we didn't get a response from them, today we set out to continue with our schedule on our way to Palisa, another district in Uganda. They stopped us again. And then when we went back to our headquarters, we found a letter from police. They're inviting us for the police leadership. They're inviting us for a meeting on Monday. We said we shall go for that meeting because we have been seeking to, you know, if they want to engage with us, that's okay. So we are going to meet them on Monday to tell them to explain to us about the double standards.
What specific issue would you raise with the police leadership when you meet on Monday?
Number one, they keep saying we are breaking the law. We want them to help us understand which law are we breaking, because the law says you write and notify police when you have a political activity. That we always do. So we don't know which law they are saying we are breaking. Number two, we want to ask them why they're operating with double standards. They allow everybody else to hold activities. For us, they treat us this way. So that's the other thing that we shall seek to ask them. Why the double standards? Because they're meant to provide us with security so that we can carry out our exercises, our activities, as the Constitution does provide. So those are the issues we want to put to them.
Responding and acknowledging to your letter dated May 23rd, the police have itemized at least 11 or so points that they said are supposed to be adhered to by all political groupings, including other civil society groupings. Are you adhering to them? Because the police are saying all they do is to enforce the law to ensure that business activities are not impeded.
We want to ask them those regulations, which, by the way, are not provided for within the law. Yeah, because we are meant to enjoy our rights, freedom of expression. Of course, that doesn't mean we infringe on anybody else's rights. That's why we inform the police. That's why the law says notify police, so that they are present to make sure that while we're doing our rallies and so on, nobody takes advantage, thieves, petty thieves, to do pickpocketing or whatever the case might be, so that nobody is infringed on. That's why we notify them to provide security. So anyhow, these regulations are illegal. But number two, they are only enforcing them against NUP. Several other politicians, some of our colleagues, by the way, political actors, are in different parts of the country. Several of them, including some of our colleagues in the opposition, which is okay, by the way. That's what it should be. But our challenge is they are enforcing these problematic regulations against NUP. Why are they so afraid of the National Unity Platform, which is led by Bobi Wine? Why?
Some Ugandans are accusing the NUP of intentionally breaking the law, and then when the laws are enforced, you turn around and accuse the police of being political and being biased against the NUP. They cited an instance where NUP supporters had beaten some journalists in some part of the country, and those residents are demanding an apology from the NUP. These are some of the issues that critics of the NUP are saying, that your supporters are unruly, they break the law, and when the law is enforced, then you cry foul.
You see, first of all, police has not raised that an issue regarding journalists. As the National Unity Platform, we respect journalism, and journalists ought to be protected. I'm a former journalist myself. I practiced journalism for 14 years. So I know that it's important that journalists are protected. And many times we have spoken out. Sometimes we are with them and police is clobbering them and we are saying, no, these are journalists doing their work. Yeah. So police has not raised this as an issue, because if they had, we'll tell them, well, investigate. But number two, these accusations, we have heard them And on our end, we are continuing to do a thorough investigation because we begin to realize that there is several political undertones. Some of the journalists who are complaining have for a long time been castigating NUP because they're used by particular politicians, some even within our party, you know, some renegades, some others belonging to the regime, on their Facebook and social media, attacking Bobi Wine, attacking NUP. These are the same people who are now, some of them, coming up to make these allegations. We have said, okay, even though in the past you have been attacking us as a party, you as individuals, we still want to understand these allegations. Help us to know from your point of view.
Joel Senyonyi is the spokesperson for the National Unity Platform, or NUP. He spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. In Tanzania, a senior medical official says the emergency medical department at the Muhimbili National Hospital has significantly improved healthcare delivery to patients. Local media says before its establishment 14 years ago, Tanzania did not have a single hospital with well-equipped emergency medicine facilities, and the country had a hospital mortality rate of nearly 14%. Dr. Juma Mfinanga is the head of the emergency medicine department at the Muhimbili National Hospital. To change the situation, he says, the government collaborated with the Abbott Philanthropic Foundation and Abbott Fund to strengthen the country's healthcare system through 160 million plus public-private partnership. It includes broader initiatives to help children and families access education and build livelihoods. To learn more about the impact of the emergency medical department on healthcare delivery at the Muhimbili Hospital and across the country, I reached Dr. Juma Mfinanga. He heads the facility's emergency medicine department.
The emergency medicine care was started in Tanzania in 2010 and started at Muhimbili National Hospital as the first emergency department in the country. When we started in 2010, there was no any emergency medicine department in the country. And I can say that was the very good decision made by the government in collaboration with the partners like Abbott Fund to open a full capacity emergency medicine department in Muhimbili National Hospital as the national hospital. So what we did, the hospital, in collaboration with other stakeholders and we as technical people, we developed the model which we operated from 2010, and then that model, we tested it internally.
How is the emergency healthcare delivery system at the Muhimbili Hospital now since this was started?
Yes, I can say what achievement we achieved is to see the significant improvement of services and also the reduction of mortality, general mortality in the hospital. We did a study comparing the mortality of the hospital before and after establishment of the emergency medicine department. And that study showed that the overall hospital mortality decreased more than 40%.
That was a very
significant achievement for emergency department in our country. That's number one. Number two, a lot of complaints which were maybe we were seeing before establishment emergency department significant was decreased, because now if you come to Muhimbili direct, you'll be received at the emergency department and the care will be starting there right after just coming to emergency department, and then you'll be treated. We improved our services at Muhimbili National Hospital significantly, and this brought a lot of impact to our health care in the hospital.
Do you think other hospitals in Tanzania should come and learn from what you have achieved so far?
Exactly. And the majority of hospitals have done that before. I can say, after this achievement in Muhimbili National Hospital, we translated the same to other hospitals. Many hospitals from other regions, they came to learn from us And still, they are coming to learn from us. And they are learning to improve the same to their hospital. And by doing that, our government, through the Ministry of Health and local government, they have a very good relationship and collaboration to make sure that all other staff working in other departments, in other hospital, they are coming to Muhimbili National Hospital to learn how they can deliver the best emergency care services in the country.
Do you see any improvements that could be made that would also increase efficiency and better healthcare delivery system?
Yes. The good achievement which has been achieved at Muhimbili National Hospital and the other hospital can be translated down to the other hospital and also connecting all emergency departments in the country to talk the same language. By doing that, we can learn from each other, we can troubleshoot the problem which is happening daily and daily, and also we can solve the challenges which we face in our daily activities. And by doing that, 100% will improve significantly our health system as now in this country.
What has been the feedback from patients who you have treated?
I can say that we are getting a lot of positive feedback from majority of patients which we are serving. And this is because now, when our patients come to us, we make sure that they are getting the services immediately and there is no delay of the service. Now, if you come to our hospital at emergency department in Muhimbili National Hospital, you will be treated within the required time. And so doing that, we are getting a lot of positive feedback and we are appreciating with the feedback which we are getting from our patient, and we keep improving where we need to improve as we are getting feedback from our client.
Dr. Juma Mfinanga is the head of the Emergency Medicine Department at the Muhimbili National Hospital. He spoke with me from the Tanzania commercial capital, Dar es Salaam. Fatou Balde, the Gambian women's rights activist and survivor fighting to end female genital mutilation, has received the 2024 International Women's Rights Award at the just-ended Geneva Summit on Human Rights and Democracy in Switzerland. She says the award comes at a time when the world is on the brink of witnessing a major regression of women's rights in her country. This as the Gambia Parliament considers repealing the law that prohibits female genital mutilation. For more about the award and its impact in the fight against the repeal of the law in June, I read Fatou Balde in the Gambian capital, Banjul.
For me, first, it shows that the world is listening and that the world is treating female genital mutilation as a form of violence against women, as a form of human rights violation. Because for a very long time, a lot of people would often say that it's a harmful cultural practice, it's a traditional practice, and, you know, the significance of the harm that FGM does to women isn't talk of enough if we look at it just as a harmful traditional practice. So for me, my first reaction is that recognition that being invited to the Geneva Summit, being awarded the Women's Rights Award signifies that the world is listening and finally treating FGM as a human rights violation, an issue that affects women and girls.
Will this award have any impact at all in the fight against female genital mutilation, particularly in the Gambia, since Parliament is considering repealing it in June?
Yes, I believe so. The Gambia is, we have a representative at the UN Human Rights Council. For many years, we were not part of that, and we are very proud that after 22 years of dictatorship and building up and becoming one of the countries that is being seen as one that has transitioned from dictatorship to democracy, we want to maintain that image. So I hope that this award would also signal our government that women's rights are human rights, and you cannot be celebrating success on rebuilding human rights when women in your country are being subjected to female genital mutilation. So I hope that also the UN Council that is sitting next month will also amplify the issue of FGM in the Gambia, because the repealing of the law in the Gambia will affect other countries that are fighting to have a law on banning FGM. Already, the Sustainable Development Goals by the UN, Sustainable Development Goal 5, aims to end FGM by 2030. So this lifting of the ban in the Gambia will have an impact in that fight, in the global fight against FGM. So I hope that this will have an impact as well, that our government and our people, especially our members of parliament, will see that this is an international issue that is being treated as one.
Supporters of lifting the restrictions are of the view that people like you, activists like you, are being sponsored by Western countries to undermine the way of life of the Gambians and religious and traditional practices, and that you cannot dictate to them how the people of the Gambia should live their lives. How do you respond to that?
Well, my response to that is that why is it that those comments are only made towards people who are fighting against gender-based violence? Why is that comment not made on other activists who are fighting other forms of human rights violation? It's often that narrative is often sent to silence us activists, so that we would think that we don't want people to think that we are fighting our culture and our tradition. The reality is FGM is a form of violence against women and girls. Whilst we love our tradition, people like me, I love my tradition and my culture. But any tradition and culture that actually harms women and girls is not one that I want to be part of. And FGM has been identified as one that does that. So for them saying the things that they say, I know it's just a way of silencing people, because we know that there are a lot of other battles in Africa that people are fighting, and such are not said about those people. So for me, I know what I do, and I know it's in the best interest of women and girls, and in the best interest of country, because when you protect women and empower them, the whole country benefits, and FGM empowers women and girls.
This activism against female genital mutilation, how are people embracing it in the Gambia, especially when there are reports that the lifting of these restrictions will proceed in parliament, and that there's a groundswell of support in parliament to lift the restrictions?
Mm-hmm. Well, firstly, I think for me, for example, I've been able to end FGM in my family. Yeah. And there are a lot of other women like me who have ended the practice in their family. Secondly, for many years, FGM for decades was seen as a taboo subject that people didn't really discuss. We have broken that culture of silence around FGM. We are taking spaces where, you know, just a few decades ago, women were not taking those spaces to talk about FGM. We are on the radios, we are on the TVs, we are at the community level. We are speaking to our parliament. As I am speaking to you today, our team are at the National Assembly giving evidence to the MPs who are trying to lift the ban. We have women from all different ages coming to these women from different generations, coming in front of the parliament and saying that we do not want the law repealed. If you see the people who are saying the law should be repealed, it's not women. It is men in position of influence, especially where either in the parliament or religious leaders who are trying to use the bodies of women as a political tool.
Fatou Baldé is the Gambia women's rights activist and survivor fighting to end female genital mutilation. She spoke with me from the Gambian capital, Banjul. Sierra Leone's President Julius Maada Bio has called on his ministers and their deputy ministers to step up efforts in helping his administration to improve the lives of citizens. At a recent two-day retreat for ministers and senior public officials, the president called on them to quote, correct and recalibrate their actions for the national agenda. This, the president added, forms part of the government's commitment to deliver on the promises it made to voters. The meeting comes as civil society and opposition groups call on the government to solve the economic challenges facing the country. For reaction to the retreat and expectations of Sierra Leoneans, I reach Abdul Fatoma. He is the chief executive director of the Campaign for Human Rights and Development.
We want to see if for the third time or the fourth time he have been saying these words to these ministers, if actually this will come to reality. Because now we don't see it as a reality, you know, position.
Some people are saying, you know, calling on his ministers to work on behalf of the people, to take the people seriously and not be lackadaisical in their work is a good enough motivation for them to go ahead and then complete the task, set ambitious yet achievable target is well and good.
The word lackadaisical is quite good for the president to use that to the ministers, because it's visible. Examples are there, like the Ministry of Water Resources and Sanitation. Very recently, their office was burnt down and they abandoned the building and government equipment and also documents, state documents, abandoned, and it was left in the hands of the landlord of that property to actually secure those documents, state documents. So we have a lot of other issues. You travel along the roadside of Freetown, you see a lot of abandoned projects. When we talk about lackadaisicalness, we have a capital city and a country that does not enjoy 24 hours electricity supply. And then we still have people who are working in those offices and they are fully paid. That when he asks his ministers actually to double up their steps, that the people don't need promises no longer, they now need actions. This is actually the expectation of the people.
Does that mean that the people expect people to be fired or for him to reshuffle the government? He just constituted the government after the recent election.
What the people want is for these ministers to deliver. You know, people want to have quality access to health or affordable health care service or access to clean pipeline water, access to stable electricity supply, access to justice. These are the things that people want to gain access to. Like
Abdul Fatoma is the chief executive director of the Campaign for Human Rights and Development. He spoke with me from the Sierra Leonean capital, Freetown. This is The Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs, and music from African Collection. But first, now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. This week, on Wednesday the 29th, the global community will surely be watching South Africans go to the polls to select their legislators, and they in turn will elect the president of the republic. Previously, attention has been drawn to the assessments of the polls, pundits, and other observers that for the first time since 1994, the ANC of Mandela, which shepherded the people of South Africa into a new era of democracy, that this time they believe ANC will fall below 50 points. This is, of course, a troubling situation for many, many, many people. But we must also be aware that there are many who have an interest in a change. In this connection, it is interesting that the ICJ, the International Court of Justice, delivered its ruling on quick days about South Africa's request for new provisional orders. There is no secret that there are those who sincerely believe that the South African government had the audacity to drag South Africa before the ICJ. For them, they would hope that the current government of South Africa leaves the stage with the hope that the case against Israel might be dropped by a new government. But there are thousands of global citizens who, for them, they would hope for the opposite, the continuation of the present government of South Africa and to continue the fight for justice before the World Court. Those people around the world have come to see South Africa as the chief prosecutor of humanity in its fight of double standards and violation of human rights, and also that of the case before the court now. What one can say sincerely is we cannot tell what the results are going to be. There are some incidents that happened in the last 12 and 10 days that make it quite difficult to discern what the results will be. These regards to the up and down of whether Jacob Zuma, the former president, should be a member of parliament or even the leader of the new party, MK. Also, the competition among the political parties to come forward as the coalition partner for a diminished ANC. And frankly, also, because of the ruling of the World Court, when it largely accepted the request of South Africa, and in this instance was so concrete in its delivery that it provides very little room for wiggling, as we have seen in previous occasions. Make no mistake, there is profound disgust and disagreement that some who believe arrogantly and without much reason for it, that they know better the intricacies of international law, the way to interpret humanitarian law, and of course, to deal with the case of genocide. For them, they also believe the government of South Africa, in pursuing the case of genocide, has shown strength, greed, and unstoppable despite the cacophony of noises, abuses, and name-calling which has become the pattern when one challenges the status quo. So this is why the global community will really want to see this week on which government in South Africa they should put their trust. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
I go make you Joe Dada. Say you get the power. City passi, I'm a lucky to Shinji Kagawa. Jesus Christ, the love hour. But them falling Yakata. You know what she's a big girl, they do. Sabi, oh, Sabi, oh, oh, Sabi, oh, Sabi. Fortune.
Our Sunday Music Spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English to Africa service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, including producer Nicole Peters and engineer Justin Thoit, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, those who sit patiently with the elders under the moonlight at the village square will drink from the wisdom of knowledge. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa. Chipiri pa kilera da savana, ayo.